so I am here with Adam Agoyan, who is the writer and director most recently of Adoration. Adam, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
First off, I had a rather funny question, but it's one concerning your films that I have been kind of obsessed with for some time. And I was pleasantly surprised to see the motif crop up again in Adoration, and that is your propensity to have shots set in airports or customs rooms. We have them at the beginning of Exotica. We have it at in Ararat. With, of course,
Felicia's
Christopher
Journey.
Plummer. Yes, Felicia's Journey. Yeah. But I noticed from Exotica onwards, every one-word film title of yours has an airport security scene or a custom line scene. I'm wondering if this is Goyan House style for a one-word title. I'm wondering if it's a scenario in which you have a particular preoccupation or a concern or an anxiety for airports. What of this?
I think that, first of all, they are the borders where someone asks you, what are you doing? Like, and how do you define yourself? And it's to me such a fundamental question. And I love that idea of having to prove who you are. And I also think it probably has to do with the fact that at a certain, age in my formation, I mean, I went through a major airport. I mean, the family moved into a new country, and so we must have been grilled by some customs agent, and I must have seen my parents break down in the process. And I'm just assuming all of this because it obviously is something that has left a huge impression on me. I actually have gone through some pretty nasty interrogations too at airports. I mean, where you try and answer a question with a joke, which is never a good idea. And I've been whisked away and gone through more intense sort of procedures. So I do think that there's this moment where if you take that question really seriously, when someone says, so what are you doing and why are you coming into this country, you can actually provoke a whole series of responses which may not necessarily be helpful or fruitful in getting you into the country where a very simple response is required. I can't really explain any more than that. It's just that I think it's and in this film certainly it's very stylized, and the whole environment of it is quite dreamlike. But it's a huge part of the beginning of the film.
I should point out the very beginning of Next of Kin features suitcases at the airport. So
absolutely.
This is why I have to. I mean, is the airport for you what the bathroom was to Kubrick? I mean,
that's a really interesting way of putting it. I would say that somehow if I can combine a bathroom with an airport, that'd probably be the best possible place I could situate any scene. But I think that there's this idea that I love passage. I mean, my films all deal with characters moving in this zone where they're in passage. They have to define themselves, and they're carrying baggage. I mean, there's baggage that sometimes is explicit, that you're aware of the contents, and other times you're not, and sometimes they're not aware of it either. And the process of the movies is in some ways about opening that baggage and going through it.
Yeah.
And as we do as viewers, and certainly as a customs agent does quite literally, inspecting what is there and trying to sort out why that person is gaining entry as a result. It could be benign, or in this particular film, it's explosive. One of the characters in the boy's imagination, anyway, was placed on this plane as a detonating device. So the security and that she goes through is has a profound effect on the lives of all these other people. So it's a place where we are allowed to imagine ourselves in a process of investigation.
Yeah, but to expand upon this notion of baggage, I should point out that Simon, who is of course videotaping various aspects of his family with his cell phone, bears a striking similarity to what Rafi is doing in Ararat,
right,
who is videotaping Mount Ararat and the like, and again,
right,
going through customs, subject to this interrogation.
Right, right.
Is it your suggestion with these often young characters that I guess the contemporary answer to baggage would in fact be shooting and trying to capture any particular memory or even the sort of vague sliver of a memory onto video, that this is the only way, I guess, the video camera itself almost forms its own kind of suitcase? I can get
it does. Well, yeah. That's exactly it. It becomes an archival instrument, and it becomes that thing that you use in passage, right? I mean, like what this boy is doing in this film is not dissimilar from what Rafi is doing in Ararat, where he is trying to use a digital technology to gain access to something which is otherwise completely abstract and ephemeral to him, you know, or there's something that is disturbing him, and the sense that in both, with both characters, that by actually loading it and by containing it, that they have some sense that they have control, that they have like some way of accessing a profoundly essential piece of text or an image that will define what their search is about. Now, that can be frustrated, and in both cases it is. In both cases, you know, when Rafi goes to tape Ararat, it's somehow not enough, you know, and it's not what he thought it would be. And in the case of Simon, when he goes to extract this confession from his grandfather and tape that on his cell phone, it's also not what he wants it to be. You know, he wants it to be a deathbed confession where the truth comes out, and all it is the grandfather maintaining this orthodoxy that his father was a demon, that his mother was, you know, this angel, that the father was responsible for the parents' death. It was a murder-suicide. The parents, you know, had died in a car accident. And, you know, the grandfather's convinced that, you know, that the best way that he can keep the mother's, his daughter's spirit alive is by demonizing the father, you know, which is just so unhealthy. And I think, you know, Simon is at a point where he understands that and he has to challenge that. But when he doesn't get that answer, he then uses the confession that the grandfather makes to prove this alternate personality. Yeah. You know, when he goes through that, he, rather than just erasing this message, he very ritualistically burns the cell phone. And so I like how these things play out physically, even though there's a degree of abstraction, like, you know, that there is a physical element that someone has to play out, either it be a search or it be a kind of a ritual that character then creates with these objects.
Yeah.
And that happens in a lot of the films, I guess, as well, you know, where something is then taken to this other place where it becomes more substantial. You know, I think that's what the characters are often searching for, is just some way of making their experience substantial to themselves.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where, you know, they can, you know, it can become theatrical, it can become like a strip dance, it can become like a, you know, something which is, that they can show to other people and has a real value.
And yet, if to actually look at the trajectory of technology throughout your film, I would argue that it's become less about closed circuit and more about open circuit,
because
you're about television, sure, yeah, and the internet in, yeah, your last four films, yeah, and yeah, so yeah. So this is really intriguing to me that,
well,
you...
it's a huge shift from the early films in the 80s where because they were closed circuit systems, there were also very there was something hierarchical about it, where certain people had access to those systems and others didn't.
Yeah.
And certain people had access to means of visual production and image production, and others were condemned just to watch. And that was certainly the case in the films from the 80s, like family viewing, speaking parts. But in each of those films, especially family viewing, which, again, is like a young man, you know, who's trying to find his past, you know, who has to physically steal these videotapes that, you know, contain his history, that that his father is taping over with homemade porn. I mean, there's still that sense that that someone can access what is a closed system. What has happened now with the internet is that anyone has the ability to make these images or distribute them, and rather than the technology becoming a barrier or a filter for our emotion, it becomes a very direct conduit, and, you know, our sense of relations with other people at an emotional level is saturated with a degree of intimacy that we couldn't have imagined before.
Yeah.
And that, though, also calls you know our ability to discern that and to work our way through that is questionable. I mean especially in this case where Simon is you know, putting a story onto the net, and, you know, at first it's intended for his schoolmates, and then it, you know, becomes it has a whole multitude of reactions that he couldn't have anticipated. That is both really exciting in terms of what it provides in terms of this plethora of responses, but it all is also quite paralyzing, because, you know, what do you do with that? What do you make of that ultimately? How do you sustain that? And I think that, you know, this boy takes the story out there, gets all these responses, but ultimately he has to then move beyond, because the internet ultimately is not designed as an instrument of catharsis. It can't be. It's too open-ended. You know, it has no resolution. The beauty of it is that it keeps opening up to other worlds.
Yes, but the chat room you have in this does not actually exist. In fact, I was curious about this. I mean, Skype, you can probably get maybe 7 or 8 people on at the same time, but it's still not going to fill up a laptop screen like the way you have it in this. And in fact, the very successful forms of software have been Twitter and Facebook, have been the written word, have been text.
Well, no, you're absolutely right. Yeah. I mean, but I'm trying to create the feeling of text-based chat rooms or Twitter visually, mm-hmm. because seeing the text is not very interesting. It's like it's in a film.
Yeah.
You're not going to get the feeling of what those technologies provide if you're focusing on text. So, you know, I mean, so there is something futuristic and also improbable about the technology that we're seeing here, because, you know, if you have that many faces, it's not like reading that many responses where you can focus on what you want. I mean, this would be quite overwhelming.
Yeah.
But I think it creates the mood of what you get through the text-based systems.
And yet, simultaneously, the pregnant girl who is at the airport is based off of Nezer Hindavi, the 1986 Syrian effort to try to bomb that plane. So in one case, you have drawn very explicitly from reality and put it into your film, and in another case, with the chat room, you've taken the essential feeling of something and transmuted it into a kind of speculative proposition.
Well, the Hindavi's story is actually a story which did happen in 1986, but you can't take it that literally within the film because, as the boy doesn't, because it wouldn't make sense that he would then be the child of that pregnant woman. In fact, you know, the child of that pregnant woman was a girl, and that woman went back to live in Ireland. And though, as a side note, what's interesting is that one of the things that provoked my using that story was that while I was writing this, it came up because he was up for parole, and he's completely unrepentant, you know, and he's currently serving, you know, the longest prison term in British history,
yeah.
you know, for this act, which was just unthinkable. But, you know, so that, yes, that story is co-opted, but, you know, it's also abstracted to an extent. You know, it is the story that the school teacher is reading, but the story that Simon then takes on is not specifically mentioning that.
Well, this is an intriguing process question, because your films at the end result often deal with how we make sense of reality and how we fabricate reality. And here we are talking about the bare bones of one of your films, in which something is taken very sort of to varying degrees of explicitness into the actual screenplay. And I'm curious as to whether you have a kind of what is precisely the criteria you place when you want to take specific details or even stretch the details, or is this even a distinction when you create a film?
I think that's a really great question. I mean, the question is, you know, does a filmmaker need to be responsible to history? And that's a huge issue, because I think that, you know, we give ourselves dramatic license, and Simon is an extreme version of that. I mean, you know, and as is his drama teacher, you know, using that as creative material. I don't think film is a place that you necessarily go, especially a dramatic, you know, narrative feature. I mean, perhaps in the world of documentary, it's designed to actually provide details. But in a film like this, I think it's really clear early on that issues of terrorism, issues of Middle Eastern politics, all sorts of religious issues that are raised are a backdrop to this boy trying to sort out his life. And as irresponsible as his journey and as reckless as it might seem at certain points, the film itself, it also becomes quite reckless. I mean, in terms of throwing these images out there, but showing that they've been completely untethered from their original intention. You know, like, you know, that's part of what the boy, you know, for instance, in the film, you know, a Christmas creche is put up in front of the family home every year, but the original idea of what that creche means has been completely lost, you know. And at one point, the boy goes back to the original scroll that his grandmother had painted for the creche, and we understand that this was done with great care by someone who was obviously very passionate about this and might have been able to transmit the spirit of this to the boy had she been there, but she's not. So we still have the artifact of it, but it doesn't really have the meaning that it might have had. Same thing with the violin. The mother has been given, this precious violin, and there's a whole history attached to the violin. It's how the parents met, and again we see the original scrolls, which show how his father, repaired the violin, and this is the meeting of his parents. But again, it's been abstracted to the point where the boy has to reimagine what might have happened. We don't know what the primal scenes were, but he, lends that. And it's this film is actually set up as a series of provocations and detonations.
Yeah,
And there are a number of statements that are being made often by the students on the chat room about capitalism, about terrorism, and it's just part of a wash. It's not, nothing that's being said is meant to be taken particularly seriously until the character of Simon embraces it and uses it, and transfigures it for his own search.
But see, what I would say about the violin, which is very interesting, is that here is this classical artistic symbol, something that we have associated with permanence, and it's being broken apart. It's being considered, should we go ahead and sell this off and the like? And you compare this against the present sort of artistic medium, something that starts off as an essay, is right before a drama class, which is then turned into this video chat room. And as a result, you have a situation in which you can't respond to a particular medium in its medium. It has to go off into its various directions, juxtaposed against this notion of the violin that's split apart. But nevertheless, in its parts, we actually understand that it's a violin. And so I'm curious about this. This gets into a sort of range of deconstruction. I have another question, actually, in relation to the fact that you have named the teacher Sabine, which, of course, is the original Italian tribe there before Rome was conquered. So it's almost as if you're suggesting that here we are at this great moment in history, or perhaps terrifying moment in cultural history, in which we may be seeing something as crazy as the Roman Empire, what with this major transition. Is this your position? That's a lot to throw at you.
It's a ton to throw at me. I mean, like, those are really exciting ideas, and they're really astute and accurate. I think that, but the film is actually suggesting that there's an order towards the material world that we have to actually re-embrace. That, and that it's not going to emerge in the way that we might have expected it to. It's this boy, goes as far as he can, using the technology to generate all sorts of different narratives, right? Like all things, when the moment he says he's the son of this person who is attempting to blow up an airplane, he is the spawn of this pregnant woman who is set up as a detonation, device for this terrorist who wanted to, conduct this act. The moment he says that, there are so many responses as to why he might be doing it, but also responses to this imaginary act. I mean, the act itself never happened, but there are people, for instance, who are mourning this, who are on that plane, whose lives could have been taken away, who suddenly see themselves as victims, and they open all sorts of issues, some of them, quite absurd, some of them, leading to, these subcultures that are spontaneously developed and are so wildly outside of this boy's control, and ultimately don't only pertain to why he went on the net in the first place, which was to gain some sort of substance to this absence in his life. He's lost his parents. He's lost that form of inheriting a tradition. And so he creates his own new tradition. He takes these objects, the violin, the creche, the cell phone sort of, confession that he extracts from his grandfather, and he reformats them physically.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where the film leads towards. And I do think that we often get very diverted and distracted by the excitement of interpretation, but we have to emerge with something specific and concrete for that to then have meaning to us.
But the question, however, is whether these people who have these desires to be victims or to have sort of online personas or to have a sort of invented narrative for themselves to possibly replace the emptiness of their lives, whether this is something that is a kind of natural human impulse or something that is taught, because it is Sabine who encourages Simon to tell his story to spread it off the net.
So, at the essence of this film is Sabine's obsession with a trajectory in her own life, which was lost. A thread was lost in her own life when she lost her husband.
Yeah.
And that provoked a very obsessive moment where she began to, we gather, to stalk this house.
Yeah.
And wanted access, you know, to that world. And she's been able to sublimate that, but then her contact with this boy and seeing this boy's fervor to embrace this story, she understands the moment she reads this translation exercise why this kid is taking this path, and she encourages it, she inspires it, but it's always as a means of her being able to gain access to her own history, her own thread. And this is where the film is quite subversive, because you know, you would think as a teacher, she'd be there to encourage him and to be generous with him. But and there are many scenes where she's not quite acting the way you would want someone in her position to act.
Yeah.
Because she's actually very consumed with her own loss, you know. And I think she comes to realize that by the end of the film. I mean, she's, you know, she knows she's gone too far, but she can't help it. She is obsessed with this boy's father. You know, I mean, this man, this figure of Sammy, and you know, the primal act of adoration is her act of adoration to this man that's been taken from her. So yes, you're right that there's something very primordial about Sabine's quest.
Yeah.
And what it is that she's looking for, and where the name is drawn from, and all those things, which is really astute of you. But you know, like that, she is the lead character in this.
Yeah.
Her, and it's all about her trying to give substance to this gaze of obsession.
Yeah, but even though she has this obsession and this trauma, she still wears a mask. She's still just as driven like a moth to the light of trauma as Simon is to the internet and the like. And the question, I guess, goes back to this pedagogical idea of whether it's instinctive or whether it really is something that we're just learning or
but it, but in her case, I mean, that mask is, it's not a natural. It's a decorative device. It's something we see on the wall of her home. She's a drama teacher. It's a Bedouin dowry mask. It's something that she can use to gain entry into this place. It is not in any way a way of. It's not attached to any particular belief system that she personally has. It's just it's a camouflage.
Yeah.
And that whole scene is very. It's a tall order for a viewer to actually know what to make of that scene when she approaches Tom's, you know, creche, you know, with that costume, because it's not a scene that invites any sort of identification. Yeah. In fact, you know,
it's a scene that invited me to like, well, geez, can we contact the teacher authority in Canada?
Yeah. Yes. You know, I mean, she it's very upsetting, but she's basically trying to construct a moment that can then allow her to come back the next night to apologize, to gain entry into the house.
Sure.
So it's got very little to do with teaching Simon anything.
Yeah.
That's a pretext for gaining access to this house. And she's going so out of bounds. I mean, she gets fired in the film for provoking this internet story, this phenomenon. But you know what she's actually done is way out of line. You know, yeah. And she, I think she understands that.
But we should also talk about the class notion in this film, which I think there's a more pronounced concern for class in this film than in many of your other films, in the sense of you having the tow truck driver who is down on his luck, and then with Sabine, she has this privilege of being able to essentially pay for a cab to follow the tow truck. She tells the cab driver, you know, you want to eat? I could eat. And so there's also this kind of bizarre division of class in relation to this.
No, but I think that's really stupid. There's also this huge division of class because we gather the grandfather is incredibly wealthy.
Yeah.
You know, and it has actually forced, you know, his own son into poverty, you know, because of the way he's withheld this trust. You know, so we gather from Simon's access to the, you know, these expensive cell phones, and you know these are gifts that might have been given to him by his grandfather.
Yeah.
You know, because they're out of whack with the way they're living.
Yeah.
Right. So it's a huge issue in the film, and I'm glad you brought that out. You know, like there is this certain people have the privilege of being able to pay for therapies that would otherwise not be extended to anyone else. And there's a there's something disturbing about that, but there's also something I think equally disturbing about Tom's insistence that, you know, he's not into drama, that he's not into role playing, but gradually we come to understand that, you know, he was this master role player that evening of this trauma, you know, and that, you know, again, there was this, I'm very interested in notions of privilege, and, you know, and people who have access to information which is privileged, you know, and that's, you know, and the dynamic of that set against this world where there's a technology that again, there's this presumption that everyone has access to the internet, but you know,
I was going to bring that up. Yeah,
no,
that's, yeah.
I mean, again, it's a Western sort of, you know, presumption that we can sort of take, but it's like it's not really true, you know, in the rest of the world.
Or is it perhaps a scenario in which everybody's perspective is worthwhile, and even including a Holocaust denier, as you have in the chat room? That this is kind of a sort of way to combat this notion that the world is some sort of equal plane. That in fact, well, some people are unfortunately better than others, or more have more to them than others, and the like.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's an incredible instrument of democratization, but it carries with it the danger of democratization, which is this proclamation of a relativist sort of theory, where, you know, there's another point of view of any position that anyone could take, and that becomes, you know, problematic as well.
One last question, because we have to get out of here, but I wanted to actually follow up on something you told interviewers after Felicia's journey about having the luxury of a constructed set to play with versus having a practical location, as you have had in all of your films before that. And now now we're a few films down, and you've had varying degrees of both sets that are constructed and practical locations, and I'm wondering what the trade-offs are for you in terms of having a constructed set or a designed set, as opposed to taking a pre-existing location in sort of like a nouveau vogue kind of way and dressing it up to suit the needs of your narrative.
It's very interesting because that came up a lot in the film I just finished shooting, Chloe, where we had a house like as a location, but, you know, the third floor was something we had to build in set because the way the place was constructed didn't afford us. And there's these scenes in the house that move very freely between the location and the set. And at this point, because we're just working out, you know, the editing, but there's this very weird energy that kind of infuses any scene that is on a constructed set, but it's also enhanced by just the sound of it, and there are incredible opportunities to shoot visually with lenses that would not work in a confined domestic space. I mean, and that to me is, you know, by nature, it means that you can abstract those characters in a design space in a way that you can't in an existing location. You know, you can put in a long lens, you can throw them, you can throw their background out of focus from them in a way that you normally can't. So there's lots of possibilities.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Well, thank you. We'll have to talk about it again.
Wow.
Thank you so much.
That's
it was a pleasure chatting with
you. That was a great question.
Yeah, great. Thanks.
Yeah. Baby got an atom bomb. A motherfucking atom bomb. Between 2 megatons. You never seen so much.